South winning the war. In 1861, the North had 20 million people and the South 9 million, 4 million of whom were slaves. Besides this 4-to-1 population advantage, the North dominated the manufacturing and munitions industries and had complete naval supremacy. These facts were known by every intelligent Southerner at the outset of the war. How then did the South hope to succeed? The answer is that the Democrats of the South hoped to fight hard and long enough to debilitate public opinion on the Union side and thus strengthen the political hand of their fellow Democrats in the North. They were counting on the Northern Democrats to thwart Lincoln and the Republicans and ultimately to defeat them so that Democrats North and South could then make a peace that permanently protected slavery. In 1862, fresh from his success at Second Bull Run, Robert E. Lee prepared his Army of Northern Virginia to invade Maryland. The present, Lee wrote on September 8, 1862 to Confederate President Jefferson Davis, seems to be the most propitious time since the commencement of the war for the Confederate Army to enter Maryland. Lee had successfully repelled Union attempts to penetrate the heart of Virginia. Now he wanted to capture and hold Union territory. One might think that his motives were military, but in fact, they were largely political. It is plain to my understanding, Lee wrote to Davis, that everything that will tend to repress the war feeling in the federal states will inure to our benefit. Ever the cautious tactician, Lee added, I do not know that we can do anything to promote the Pacific feeling, but our course ought to be shaped as not to discourage it. Voters would go to the polls in November 1862 to determine whether they will support those who favor a prolongation of the war or those who wish to bring it to a termination. Progressive accounts of the Civil War dwell needlessly on the South's efforts to draw England and France into the war on the Confederate side. In reality, both were far-fetched prospects and the Southerners knew it. Lee's letter does not even mention foreign intervention. Rather, Lee focuses on Northern public opinion and the forces that he knew were working diligently to steer it in the upcoming election against Lincoln and the Union armies, namely the Northern Democrats. Lee chose Maryland carefully. He knew that there was strong pro-Confederate sentiment in that state, and citizens of Baltimore had rioted against Lincoln in April 1861. Many secessionist members of the legislature, as well as the mayor of Baltimore, every one of them a Democrat, had been locked up for weeks that fall. Lee hoped that his incursion would embolden the pro-Confederate Democrats in Maryland to withdraw the state from the Union, dealing a crippling blow to Lincoln and the Republicans. Thus, Lee's military actions in the second year of the war were closely attentive to the effect they would have on Northern Democrats. And Lee's assessment proved to be at least partially sound. Maryland did not secede, but the Northern Democrats did very well in the 1862 midterm election, winning several states that had gone for Lincoln just 2 years earlier. Undoubtedly, both Lee and Jefferson Davis monitored those results. From their point of view, the Northern Democrats were going to be the ones who would help them save the plantation. Fire in the rear. Lincoln, for his part, understood the grave threat posed by the Northern Democrats. In January 1863, he told Republican Senator Charles Sumner that he feared the fire in the rear, which is to say, a faction of Northern Democrats, even more than he feared the Confederate Army. Here, Lincoln was not thinking of his old political nemesis, Stephen Douglas. Douglas, in what was surely his finest moment, vigorously opposed secession. He undertook a dangerous journey south to Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia to attempt to convince his fellow Democrats not to break from the Union. But Douglas died unexpectedly in June 1861, shortly after the war commenced. Nor was Lincoln concerned about the Democratic Party as a whole, at least not initially. The Democratic Party in the North had split into two factions, the so-called War Democrats and the Peace Democrats. Many Northern Democrats, including hundreds of thousands of German and Irish immigrants, fought gallantly for the Union, and the battlefield heroism of the Irish Brigade, including its Regiment 69 charge at Fredericksburg into incoming cannon fire, became legendary among Tammany Irish families back home in New York and elsewhere. Lincoln was worried about the Peace Democrats, a group that included former Ohio Congressman Clement Vallandigham and Alexander Long, former New York Governor Horatio Seymour, New York City Mayor Fernando Wood, and Indiana Senator Daniel Voorhees. In line with Lincoln's statement about them, Republicans called the Peace Democrats copperheads, likening them to deadly snakes who seem harmless enough until they strike without warning. The Peace Democrats were strengthened by early Confederate successes in the Civil War. They sought to rally public opinion against what Vallandigham called a wicked and senseless conflict. "Stop fighting," Vallandigham urged Lincoln and the Republicans. "Make an armistice. Withdraw your army from the seceded states." Such a recipe in Lincoln's mind would surely spell the death of the Union, or at least of any Union, worth preserving. Lincoln could take solace, at least in the early years of the war, from the support of the War Democrats. Yet this group was not without its problems, as far as Lincoln and the Republicans were concerned. War Democrats opposed secession as unconstitutional rebellion and treason. They were, in this respect, Union men. Yet for the most part, they had no intention of fighting a war over slavery. They communicated this unambiguously to Lincoln. Lincoln needed the allegiance of the War Democrats. As historian David Herbert Donald tells us, Lincoln was fully cognizant that he had been elected in 1860 with a minority of the vote, and that only the schism in the Democratic Party that produced two separate candidates, Douglas in the North and Breckinridge in the South, had divided the Democratic vote and enabled his victory. Lincoln knew that notwithstanding its advantage in population and resources, the North needed a united front of Northern Democrats and Republicans to defeat an undivided South. This is why Lincoln, in his famous letter to Horace Greeley, wrote that, "My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that." Lincoln framed the war as a war over Union, rather than a war over slavery, in part to keep the allegiance of the War Democrats. Remarkably, Democrats today invoke Lincoln's words to portray him as insufficiently anti-slavery, even though he was politically constrained to speak that way to keep a majority of Democrats on the side of the Union. The second reason for Lincoln's tactical decision to define the Civil War as a war over Union was to prevent the border states from seceding. The border states, Maryland, Delaware, Kentucky, and Missouri, all had slaves. In fact, there were 450,000 slaves in those four states. Yet, they had opted not to secede, even though powerful forces in those states continued to push them to join the Confederacy. Lincoln did not believe he could afford to lose these states and still win the war. He once joked that he hoped God was on his side, but without Kentucky, he wasn't sure that was even enough. Thus, Lincoln believed he would best hold the border states and thus serve the anti-slavery cause itself by pretending that this was not a war fought over slavery. Yet, of course, Lincoln could have avoided the war and saved the Union had he embraced the Crittenden proposal or simply adopted Douglas's doctrine of popular sovereignty. The fact that he refused to do so proves that Lincoln was willing to go to war to prevent slavery from spreading into the territories. Once Lincoln was convinced he had secured the loyalty of the border states, he candidly acknowledged that the root cause of the Civil War was, in fact, slavery. Without slavery, the rebellion could never have existed, Lincoln wrote in his annual message to Congress in 1862. Without slavery, it could not continue. In a later correspondence with a group of British working men, Lincoln said the rebellion was an effort to overthrow the principle that all men were created equal, and that the ensuing war was a test of whether a free government can be maintained against an effort to build one upon the exclusive foundation of human bondage. In saying this, of course, Lincoln was doing no more than agreeing with the Confederate leaders, Jefferson Davis and Alexander Stevens, who insisted that they were fighting on behalf of racism and slavery. Davis, for instance, told the Confederate Congress on April 29, 1861, that the goal of the Republicans was one of rendering the property in slaves so insecure as to be comparatively worthless. And thus it was worth going to war to save slave property worth thousands of millions of dollars. In what has come to be known as the Cornerstone Speech, delivered on March 21, 1861, Alexander Stevens said that while the American founders considered all men created equal, our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world, based upon this great physical and moral truth. What could be clearer about the defining issue that produced the cataclysm of the American Civil War? Ultimately, Lincoln revealed his hand regarding the centrality of slavery to the war with his issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation. Yet even this, the decisive measure that Lincoln emphasized, had been taken not under his normal constitutional powers, which he had previously insisted gave him no power over slavery in the states where it existed, but only under wartime necessity, is now derided by progressive pundits and historians. They scornfully point out that Lincoln freed slaves only where he had no power to free them, and kept them in captivity in states where he could actually have freed them. Once again, Lincoln carefully calibrated what he was doing. He sought to weaken the Southern slaves' attachment to the plantation. He sought to motivate free blacks in the North to offer their services to the Union cause. And he was determined to keep the slave-owning border states in the Union. Had Lincoln freed the slaves in the border states, most, if not all, of those states would have promptly defected to the Confederate side. The effect of the Emancipation Proclamation. Yet the Emancipation Proclamation gravely weakened Lincoln's support among Northern Democrats. These Northern Democrats used the pretext of its promulgation to turn irrevocably against Lincoln. As historian Jennifer Weber writes in her book Copperheads, "Deeply racist Democrats who had supported the war when its only purpose was maintaining the Union jumped to the opposition when the confrontation became an effort to free the slaves." Emancipation, in other words, was the alchemy that turned war Democrats into peace Democrats. The tone of Democratic opposition can be seen in resolutions passed by Democratic majorities in Indiana and Illinois, demanding that Lincoln retract his wicked, inhuman, and unholy Emancipation Proclamation. The Chicago Times, a Democratic paper, denounced emancipation as a monstrous usurpation, a criminal wrong, and an act of national suicide. By 1864, the Peace Democrats dominated the Democratic Party. The party nominated a war Democrat, George McClellan, to challenge Lincoln's re-election bid, but the platform was completely controlled by the Peace Democrats. The Democrats' very slogan, "The Constitution as it is, and the Union as it was," reflected the Peace Democrats' insistence that they wanted America to go back to the Union as it was prior to the Emancipation Proclamation and the Civil War itself. In sum, they demanded a restoration of slavery. The Democrats had a good chance to win. The war had dragged on, seemingly interminably, with even Republican stalwart Horace Greeley grieving for our bleeding, bankrupt, almost dying country, eager nearly above all else to halt the prospect of fresh conscriptions, of further wholesale devastations, and of new rivers of human blood. Once again, in their customary style, the Democrats launched racist attacks against Lincoln, nicknaming him Abraham Africanus the First, and announcing his Ten Commandments, the first of which was, "Thou shalt have no other god but the Negro." Lincoln dourly remarked in 1864 that there is no proposal offered by any wing of the Democratic Party, but that must result in the permanent destruction of the Union. And here he was referring to the Northern Democrats as a whole, the War Democrats, no less than the Peace Democrats. By this point, historian David Herbert Donald tells us he gave up on winning the support of the War Democrats, most of whom quietly returned to their allegiance to the Democratic Party. For Lincoln, the Northern Democrats, no less than the Southern Democrats, were dedicated to the dissolution of the nation as a novus ordo seclorum, which is to say, as the founders envisioned it. It is hardly an exaggeration to say that the Democrats nationwide were intent on murdering that America. The murder attempt failed. Lincoln was reelected, and the Union armies finally prevailed in the Civil War. This convinced a man from Maryland who thought of himself as a Northern Democrat with Southern sympathies that our cause is almost lost and something decisive and great must be done. The man was John Wilkes Booth. Booth finally fulfilled the numerous calls for Lincoln's assassination that had been ringing in Democratic newspapers, pamphlets, and public rhetoric. In the heat of the 1864 campaign, for instance, the La Crosse, Wisconsin Democrat, edited by Copperhead Marcus Pomeroy, urged that if Lincoln were reelected, "we trust some bold hand will pierce his heart with dagger point for the public good." Today, progressives portray Booth as a deranged lone wolf, but his view that America would be better off with Lincoln dead was shared by other Democrats, both in the North and in the South. Booth merely put their thoughts into action by actually killing the president. The incident that seems to have activated Booth's conspiracy was a speech by Lincoln endorsing the idea of black suffrage. "That means nigger citizenship," Booth said, taking the orthodox Democratic position on the subject. That's the last speech he will ever make. As he jumped onto the stage in the theater where the assassination took place, Booth shouted out, "Sic semper tyrannis! Thus be the fate of tyrants." But of course it was a lie in the classic Democratic fashion. The supreme irony is that Booth's was the cause of tyranny and human bondage. So deluded was Booth that he regarded the right to enslave other human beings as a form of liberty worth killing and in the end dying for. Thus we see a Democrat who represented the cause of the plantation, the cause of tyranny, using the mask of anti-tyranny to justify murdering a man who is perhaps more nobly embodied the striving for human freedom than any figure in history. And today the Democrats, the party that protected slavery and killed the man who ended it, have the chutzpah to blame the institution's legacy on the very party that stopped them. A squid-like cloud. Now we turn to Reconstruction, a period whose storytelling is dominated by the towering figure of Eric Foner. Foner is a capable historian who, nevertheless, as a progressive leftist, does his best to hide Democratic responsibility for resisting Republican Reconstruction. He also attempts to flip the blame for slavery and racism onto the Republican right. Foner wants his readers to think that the plantation was somehow a right-wing institution that was bravely overthrown by an early generation of American progressives. Earlier, we saw how Foner disingenuously portrays the South as conservative, even though its leaders were Democrats who advanced a pro-slavery ideology that, far from being conservative, was unique in world history and represented a radical break with the founding. Foner also counts Lincoln as a progressive, even though, as we have seen, Lincoln was a self-described conservative who insisted he was merely implementing the shared principles of the founders. Foner is shameless in the way he distorts ideological labels, relying on his peers to recognize his service to the progressive cause and to uphold his distortions, as most indeed do. Even so, as we will see, Foner's squid-like cloud of ideology sometimes dissipates, and a ray of truth breaks through. Reconstruction wasn't just about extending rights to blacks, nor was it just about settling the terms for the readmission of rebel states into the Union. While he lived, Lincoln considered this an administrative rather than a constitutional problem, because as far as he was concerned, secession was unconstitutional, and therefore the rebel states had never actually left the Union. Reconstruction in its broadest sense was about rebuilding the nation in a manner that realized the full vision of the founders. It was about achieving Lincoln's goal of reconciling the Declaration's twin propositions, created equal and consent of the governed. The Republicans in Congress who drove Reconstruction realized that perhaps for the first time in history, there was an elected government that supported not merely emancipation from slavery, but also full equality of rights and full enfranchisement for blacks. Admittedly, this majority would not have existed had Southern Democrats also been represented, but by their own choice, they had resigned their positions in Congress and thus forfeited their right to have their votes counted. Reconstruction represented a mortal threat to a Democratic Party whose national prospects depended upon an alliance to save the slave plantation. Some Democrats during this period wondered whether the Democrats would now go the way of the Whigs and become extinct. Perhaps the Republican Party would now, in the 1860s, become the sole party in America in the same manner that Jefferson's Democratic Republican Party had been the sole party when the Federalist Party dissolved. Democrats during the Reconstruction period vowed they would not let this happen. One way or another, they would fight Reconstruction and make a last-ditch effort to save the plantation. The magnificent scope of Republican Reconstruction can be seen in three landmark constitutional amendments. The 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, the 14th Amendment extending equal rights under the law to all citizens, and the 15th Amendment granting blacks the right to vote. These amendments went beyond unbinding the slave and making him a freeman. They also made him a U.S. citizen with the right to cast his ballot and to the full and equal protection of the laws. These amendments represented the most important moment for American constitutionalism since the Constitution was first drafted and ratified. The entire civil rights movement of the 1960s would be impossible without them. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 relied heavily on the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 on the 15th Amendment. Yet progressive historical accounts, as well as progressive textbooks, say very little about the debate over the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. The reason becomes obvious when we break down the partisan vote on those amendments. One might have thought that after the Civil War, the 13th Amendment would be a fait accompli. One might expect that every Democrat, at least every Northern Democrat, represented in Congress, would now vote for it. In fact, only 16 of 80 Democrats did. Let's pause to digest that for a minute. Even in the aftermath of the Civil War, so strong was their attachment to the plantation that an overwhelming majority of Northern Democrats refused to vote to permanently end slavery. Again, we are speaking of Northern Democrats. Southern Democrats, who might have been expected to vote against the amendment, were not permitted to vote at all. And when the 13th Amendment went to the states for ratification, only Republican states carried by Lincoln voted for it. Democratic states that went for McClellan all voted no. On the 14th and 15th Amendments, the Democratic Party's performance was even more disgraceful. Not a single Democrat, either in the House or the Senate, voted for either amendment. To repeat, these were not Southern Democrats who were excluded from voting. These were Northern Democrats so averse to extending equal rights under the law or voting rights to blacks that not a single one of them could bring himself to vote for either measure. So the 14th and 15th Amendments can be considered exclusively Republican achievements, since no Democrats contributed to making them part of the Constitution. Now we can see why progressives don't want people to know about these amendments, despite their obvious importance. They belie the progressive narrative that the Northerners were the good guys and the Southerners the bad guys. They show the Republican Party to be the only friend of blacks in the critical period following the Civil War, and they expose the Democratic Party as the true party of white supremacy, still fighting to hold on to the slave plantation. Thus, Eric Foner conveniently omits the partisan roll call vote on each one of these amendments. He gives us all kinds of minutia about Reconstruction, but somehow leaves out how the Republicans and Democrats each voted on the crucial issues of whether blacks could no longer be slaves, vote, and enjoy equal rights under the law. Is this omission a mere oversight? Whatever his intention, Foner's narrative leaves the false impression that Reconstruction was driven by a series of political conflicts between enlightened Northern progressives and wicked Southern conservatives. Republicans included two other significant measures as part of their Reconstruction. The first was the Civil Rights Act of 1866, significant not merely in that it was America's first civil rights law, but also in that it invalidated racially discriminatory laws in the North, no less than in the South. Thus, it represented a powerful Republican blow against white supremacy. Second, Republicans sought to give freed slaves a start in life by giving them access to education and also ownership of land confiscated from the Confederacy. The Civil War itself supplied a precedent for this. Toward the end of the war, Union General William Sherman issued Special Field Order No. 15, which reserved coastal land in Georgia and South Carolina for liberated slaves. Using this model framework, Republicans through the Freedmen's Bureau attempted America's first reparations law, colloquially described as 40 acres and a mule. In its most expansive reading, reparations meant, in the words of Republican Senator Charles Sumner, seizing the land of the slave planters and dividing it among patriot soldiers, poor whites, and freedmen. The politics of terror. These measures were opposed by Lincoln's successor, President Andrew Johnson. By this time, it will come as no surprise for anyone to learn that Johnson was a Democrat. Lincoln put him on the ticket because he had opposed secession and was a Union man. Lincoln hoped that Johnson might attract Southern Unionists to the cause and also help generate bipartisan support for the war. Yet Johnson remained a Democratic loyalist and, once he became president, connived to defeat Republican Reconstruction and restore, as much as possible, the Southern status quo ante. Democrats at the time loved Johnson and cheered his efforts. Today's progressive Democrats take the opposite view, publicly distancing themselves from Johnson. They downplay his Democratic affiliation and claim that, as a Southerner, he had always had secret plantation sympathies. This is actually false. As Foner himself tells us, Johnson grew up dirt poor in Tennessee and hated the planter aristocracy. Johnson's real reason for opposing Reconstruction was that he always had not-so-secret party sympathies. After the war, he spoke openly about attempting to restore the coalition of Northern and Southern Democrats that had ruled the country since the Jackson-Van Buren era in the late 1820s and early 1830s. Johnson vetoed the Civil Rights Act of 1866, but fortunately Republicans had a strong enough majority to override his veto. Johnson was more successful in thwarting the Freedmen's Bureau, the Republican mechanism for giving newly freed blacks a fresh start. Through a systematically enforced policy of lax pardons, Johnson restored plantations to their former owners, thus depriving the Bureau of land that was available to issue to blacks. Thus ended 40 acres and a mule, a policy worth trying that was abolished by a Democratic president intent on restoring what he could of the plantation and of the ideology of white supremacy. In December 1867, Johnson, in his annual message to Congress, asserted that African Americans possess less capacity for government than any other race of people. He added that no independent government of any form has ever been successful in their hands. On the contrary, wherever they have been left to their own devices, they have shown a constant tendency to relapse into barbarism. Foner admits that Johnson's diatribe is probably the most blatantly racist pronouncement ever to appear in an official state paper of an American president. Democrats also struck at the Republicans' attempts to include blacks in the Southern economy. Republicans sought to do this by protecting the rights of blacks to make contracts and by assuring that they could also exercise their newly won right to vote. The black ballot, in particular, was a serious threat to the Democratic Party. Starting in 1866, blacks organized themselves into union leagues throughout the South. They allied with northern whites who had moved south, the group the Democrats called carpetbaggers, as well as with sympathetic southern whites, the group the Democrats called scalawags. In 1867 to 1869, during the Constitutional Conventions, blacks and whites jointly participated in political deliberations for the first time in the nation's history. During this golden decade, approximately 2,000 blacks were elected to important political office in the South. There were 2 black senators, 16 black congressmen, and more than 600 blacks in the state legislatures. In addition, nearly 1,000 blacks held various local offices. Many of them were former slaves. Every single one of them was a Republican. In fact, blacks dominated the Republican Party in the South during the Reconstruction era. Democrats in the South resolved not merely to crush the black Republicans, but also to kill in its cradle America's embryonic experiment in multiracial democracy. This time, the Democratic weapon was a deadly and murderous one, the invisible empire of the Ku Klux Klan, an organization led by Nathan Bedford Forrest, a former slave trader, Confederate general, and delegate to the 1868 Democratic National Convention. Democrats also founded dozens of other domestic terrorist organizations. For nearly a decade in the 1860s and early 1870s, the Klan and similar groups conducted a reign of terror throughout the South, targeting not only blacks, but also white Republicans who had gone South to help educate blacks and integrate them into the political process. Klansmen murdered black officials, black voters, and also carpetbaggers and scalawags. They hated blacks for being blacks, and Republicans for attempting to treat blacks as human and extend to them the same rights enjoyed by whites. As David Chalmers writes in his book Hooded Americanism, the Klan's preferred techniques of political action were shooting, burning, and lynching. And these gruesome acts were often conducted with large Democratic crowds in attendance, eating and drinking, as they took in torture as a form of entertainment. Traveling through the South, the Republican official Carl Schurz was horrified to see in one county after another decomposing corpses suspended from trees or lying in ditches and on roadways. The Republican Congress held hearings on Klan atrocities and passed laws, collectively called the Force Bill, authorizing the prosecution of these terrorist lawbreakers. As a consequence of Republican pressure, the Klan went defunct and shut its doors, although it would see a revival early in the 20th century. During this period, when the KKK ceased to exist, other terrorist groups, like the Knights of the White Camellia, took up the Democratic cause. Moreover, the Klan had, in its short but extremely violent tenure, largely accomplished its purpose to intimidate black voters and drive Republican reformers out of the South. In a remarkable admission, Eric Foner writes that in the postbellum era, the Klan was a military force serving the interest of the Democratic Party. Foner's admission is remarkable because it is so rare. Foner, for once, actually makes an incriminating generalization about the Democratic Party, and what a damaging admission it is. Foner makes it clear that, as a domestic terrorist group serving at the behest of a political party, the Klan resembles the Nazi brown shirts of the 1920s and 1930s. They were the domestic terrorist arm of the Nazi party. There is that glimpse of ideological truth in Foner, and then he is back to his old ways. Foner concludes his book with the glum observation that Reconstruction came to a rude halt in the late 1870s, but he never gives the root cause for this. The root cause is that partly through political obstructionism, but mostly through domestic terrorism carried out by organizations like the Klan, the Democrats defeated the Republican attempt to protect blacks, enfranchise them, and give them a chance to make their own American dream. Weary Republicans reeling from what historian Joel Williamson terms battle fatigue finally retreated from the South, leaving it in the dirty hands of the Democratic Party. The Democrats lost the Civil War, but they denied the Republicans the chance to build a decent peace. This is the whole meaning of what Foner writes, and yet it is the conclusion that he peremptorily resists. So do Barbara Fields, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and the whole procession of progressive scholars and pundits. I guess I shouldn't be shocked that these intellectual partisans aren't particularly eager to tell us that their own party destroyed the postbellum hopes of the African-American community. Still, for all their limitations, we should not lose sight of what the Republicans did accomplish. They saved the country and vanquished the old Democratic plantation, which lay in ruins after the Civil War. Even though progressives keep telling us about the lost cause, supposedly the cause of the Confederacy, the death of the Democratic plantation was the real lost cause. The Confederacy was merely the means to save the Democratic plantation. It was the plantation that gave rise to the Democratic Party, and it was for the plantation the Democrats fought so viciously and so bitterly. Now that it was gone, the Democrats found themselves in a miserable position. They were like the rebel angels in Milton's Paradise Lost, hurled headlong, flaming from the ethereal sky, and now confused and dazed in a hell of their own making. For the first time, before they gathered their wits, it was dark despair and pure pandemonium. Yet just like Lucifer and his horrid crew, as Milton describes them, the Democrats were not about to submit. Rather, in the manner of Belial, Beelzebub, and the rest, they drew resolution from despair and shook their fists in rage at the Republicans, seeking not merely to undermine Republican projects like Reconstruction, but to make a full comeback themselves. They vowed not, as progressives would have us believe, that the South will rise again, but rather, what progressives like to conceal from us, that the Democratic Party will rise again. They were determined to reinvent the plantation. Chapter 6. Progressive Plantation. White Supremacy as a Weapon of Re-Enslavement. It was a menace to society itself that the Negro should thus of a sudden be set free and left without tutelage or restraint. Woodrow Wilson, History of the American People. In the critical election year of 1912, the progressive African-American scholar W.E.B. Du Bois faced a choice. Should he endorse the former Republican, Theodore Roosevelt, now running on the progressive Bull Moose ticket, or the Democrat, Woodrow Wilson, also running on a progressive platform? In general ideological terms, both men were similar, and Du Bois, sharing the same outlook, could hardly distinguish them on that basis. Even so, on racial grounds alone, the choice for Du Bois should have been an easy one. Du Bois knew that the Democrats, both in the North and the South, had been the party of the old plantation. They had fought to protect the plantation. through the Civil War and had largely, successfully blocked Republican Reconstruction. Far from repenting of their long legacy of bigotry and enslavement, the Democrats, especially in the South, were scheming for ways to restore and reinvent the plantation in the 20th century. Wilson was part of this scheme of Virginia Democrat, who as a young boy had watched in horror as Union armies occupied the South. This trauma had inevitably shaped his basic worldview. True, Wilson as a young man migrated north to New Jersey, where he became the president of Princeton and governor of the state. This northern experience changed Wilson, but not in the way we might think. Instead of moving away from his old bigotries, Wilson acquired new fortification for them in the so-called scientific racism of the fin de siècle. In short, he became even more racist than he had been before. We see this in Wilson's scholarly output, which we can assume that Du Bois, himself an historian and sociologist, knew well. In 1889, Wilson published The State, a survey on the origins of government and civilization. Drawing on a new scientific taxonomy devised in Europe, but gaining ground in American universities, much of it deriving from an attempt to apply Darwin's theories to human populations, Wilson argued that the history of civilization is best understood in terms of the accomplishments and failures of various races. American democracy, in Wilson's view, was not an American creation. Rather, it was a racial legacy dating back to the ancient German Teutonic tribes, whom Wilson dubbed the Aryans. Wilson credited most achievements in the areas of government and social development to these Aryan people. Other races, Wilson insisted, lack the capacity for democratic self-government, which was essentially an Anglo-Saxon product. Wilson, in short, was an early apostle of the 19th century movement to invoke science on behalf of white supremacy. In 1901, Wilson published an article in the Atlantic Monthly in which he made the case for the segregation laws that the Democratic Party was at the time enacting throughout the South. Free blacks, Wilson argued, were unpracticed in liberty, unschooled in self-control, never sobered by the discipline of self-support, never established in any habit of prudence, insolent and aggressive, sick of work, covetous of pleasure. Obviously, they needed segregation, Wilson concluded, because otherwise they would be a danger to themselves as well as to those whom they had once served. Wilson's magnum opus was his five-volume History of the American People, the tone of which can be captured in a telling section. Returning to his theme of the unschooled Negro, Wilson wrote that as a result of his indolence and viciousness, the tasks of ordinary labor stood untouched. The idler grew insolent, dangerous. Nights went anxiously by for fear of riot and incendiary fire. Until at last there had sprung into existence a great Ku Klux Klan, an invisible empire of the South, bound together in loose organization to protect the Southern country from some of the ugliest hazards of a time of revolution. Running against Wilson was the Rough Rider, nicknamed T.R., who would seem from his record to be a far better candidate for Du Bois to support. Roosevelt was not uncontaminated by the Darwinian racialism that was all the rage in progressive intellectual precincts. He, too, spoke of the survival of the stronger races and the ultimate extinction of the lesser ones. Yet T.R. was a New Yorker, a Union man, and a Republican. He embraced Lincoln and Reconstruction. He condemned lynching and the Klan. Unlike Wilson, and at considerable political risk to himself, he sought to build bridges to the black community and integrate blacks into the postbellum South. In 1901, Roosevelt, as the newly elected president, invited the most prominent black leader in America, Booker T. Washington, to dinner at the White House. T.R.'s natural decency can be seen in his description of the offhand way the invitation came about. It seemed to me natural to ask him to dinner to talk over his work, and the very fact that I felt a moment's qualm on inviting him because of his color made me ashamed of myself and made me hasten to send out the invitation. Born a slave, Washington had risen to prominence as a black educator and statesman, founder of the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. Washington, like T.R., was a Republican who subscribed to the Republican ideology of free people, free labor, and free markets. T.R. knew Washington's deep ties to African-American farmers, teachers, small businessmen, and clergy, and he sought to create a working relationship with them. A few years later, in 1905, Roosevelt visited Washington's Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. The significance of these actions, especially the 1901 dinner at the White House, can hardly be grasped today. America just had a two-term black president, Barack Obama, and it's commonplace now to have blacks at state functions and at the White House. Blacks and other minorities, from Ben Carson to Nikki Haley, are a visible presence in the Trump administration. The atmosphere could not have been more different a century ago in the early 1900s. Roosevelt's dinner invitation provoked the tempestuous ire of Democratic racists throughout the South. "The action of President Roosevelt in entertaining that nigger," fumed Democratic Senator Benjamin Tillman of South Carolina, "will necessitate our killing 1,000 niggers in the South before they will learn their place." Mississippi's James Vardaman, a former congressman who would be elected to the Senate as a Democrat that year, said, following the dinner, that the White House was now "so saturated with the odor of the nigger that the rats have taken refuge in the stables." What, you might ask, was the big deal? The big deal was that once blacks were freed from slavery, the issue became whether they should enjoy equality of rights with whites. The most potent symbol of this was social equality, which included the right to socialize on equal terms with whites, to sit down to dinner with them, even to marry their sons and daughters. This was the explosive significance of the Roosevelt-Washington rendezvous at the White House. It was the original, real-life, guess who's coming to dinner. Will the real Uncle Tom please stand up? Yet it was precisely that 1901 meeting that fortified Du Bois' hatred of Roosevelt. Du Bois, you see, was the second most famous black leader in America. He was undoubtedly the country's leading African-American intellectual and was the first black to get a Ph.D. in philosophy from Harvard. Even so, Du Bois was a prickly and pretentious figure. Since most people pronounced his name Du Bois, he insisted that they should say Du Bois. He wore three-piece suits and adorned his outfits with a hat and a cane. When challenged in academic quarters, he was known to convey a European sophistication and superiority by drawing out his monocle. He sought to inherit from Frederick Douglass the position of the leading representative of the African-American community. In dismay, he watched as this title seemed to pass seamlessly from Douglass to Washington, one Republican to another. To Du Bois's horror, Timothy Thomas Fortune, editor of the New York Age and the most influential black journalist of the era, explicitly likened Washington to Douglass, and even published an article raising the question of whether Washington was the Negro Moses. Du Bois found it hard to believe that American elites in the North, no less than the South, kowtowed to the homespun former slave, whom Du Bois considered barely an educator, let alone his equal. In his best-known book, The Souls of Black Folk, Du Bois launched an intemperate attack on Washington, accusing him of being a sellout and an Uncle Tom. To my knowledge, this is the first time that the Uncle Tom accusation appears in American politics. Du Bois alleged that while he and others were fighting for blacks to have civil rights and full access to American opportunities, including higher education, Washington sought to accommodate Southern segregation and to teach blacks nothing better than vocational skills in preparation for manual occupations. This critique of Washington, launched by a leading progressive, has now become standard fare in progressive academia and media. Typical is the left-wing historian Lewis Harlan's unremittingly hostile two-volume biography of Washington. Harlan portrays the subject as a racial and ideological sellout, while he views Du Bois as a heroic resister on behalf of full legal and social equality. Today, Republican intellectuals like Thomas Sowell and Republican cabinet officials like Ben Carson are scornfully dismissed as Uncle Toms in the Booker T. Washington mode. Progressive intellectuals like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Cornel West like to think of themselves in the Du Bois role of glorious resistors. Yet a closer look reveals that Washington was the resistor and Du Bois was the sellout. After all, it was Du Bois who, largely on grounds of personal arrogance and resentment, backed Woodrow Wilson over TR. As we will see in this chapter, Wilson was almost single-handedly responsible for the national revival of the Ku Klux Klan, an organization that had been defunct since the 1870s. Wilson also segregated the federal government and promoted vicious schemes of forced sterilization of racial minorities. These schemes were eventually taken up by the Nazis in a macabre session of policies that moved from mass sterilization to mass murder to the Holocaust. Thus, I agree with Jonah Goldberg's assessment that Wilson was the most racist president of the 20th century, and this is whom Du Bois actually supported. Washington, by contrast, did nothing so egregious to harm and set back his fellow African Americans. Why then is Du Bois portrayed as a hero and Washington spurned as an Uncle Tom by progressives? To fully appreciate the absurdity, we need to probe more deeply the meaning of the term Uncle Tom. In Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, the slave character Tom is the noble, long-suffering protagonist. He is not a sellout or a traitor to blacks. That use of the term came decades later as blacks and others looked back at slavery and sought to distinguish those who resisted the institution and those who sustained it. Somehow poor Tom's name became a symbol of shameful collaboration. In this context, it's helpful to consider how Malcolm X in the 1960s used the term Uncle Tom. He used it to designate the house slave as compared with the field slave. As Malcolm X saw it, the field slave was the true resister of slavery. He was the bad nigger. By contrast, the house slave made his peace with slavery. In the Malcolm X narrative, when the big house on the plantation was burning, the field slave rejoiced. While the house slave rushed to the owner and said, "Massa, our house is burning. Our house." The house slave identified with the master and accommodated himself to the oppression of slavery. Now, Malcolm X did not suggest that the house slave liked slavery, merely that he accommodated himself to it. On this basis, Malcolm X dubbed him an Uncle Tom. But concealed in Malcolm X's distinction was the fact that the field slave also accommodated himself to slavery. He might have tried to run away or organize a slave revolt. In reality, there were hardly any slave revolts and no successful ones. But the field slave, no less than the house slave, was powerless to actually stop slavery. So both in the end accommodated an institution that they were in no position to do anything about, and the house slave was therefore no more of an Uncle Tom than the field slave. In the same manner, Booker T. Washington accommodated segregation in the South because he had no power to end it. He emphasized black self-help because this was the only practical way for blacks to advance in the entirely inhospitable democratic environment of the Deep South. Even so, it may be asked whether he adopted available measures to fight for legal equality. The answer, generally suppressed in progressive accounts of him, is that yes, he did. In a recent biography, historian Robert Norrell highlights facts that have been downplayed or omitted in progressive accounts. He shows that Washington spoke out regularly against lynching and lobbied Congress for legislation to outlaw it, condemned railway segregation in speeches and articles, and lobbied the rail companies to stop it, funded lawsuits to block Democratic campaigns to deprive blacks of their voting rights, condemned the unfairness of the sharecropping system that robbed black farmers of their earnings, and supported a black defendant, Alonzo Bailey, in a landmark 1911 Supreme Court case, Bailey versus Alabama, striking down the discriminatory and oppressive practice of peonage. Taken as a whole, Washington did more in practical terms than Du Bois to combat segregation in particular and white supremacy in general. Note that while Du Bois railed against segregation throughout the early part of the 20th century, he accomplished nothing in terms of curtailing it. Washington's accommodation is reminiscent of how the founders and even Lincoln accommodated slavery. These men did what they could within their power to restrict what was beyond their power to instantly eliminate. No one can be reasonably criticized for that. An appreciation for Hitler. While we can understand Du Bois's attack on Washington as the bitter recriminations of a lesser man, this still doesn't fully explain Du Bois' bizarre endorsement of Wilson. Du Bois insisted in 1912 that Wilson will treat black men and their interests with far-sighted fairness. He will not seek further means of Jim Crow insult. He will not dismiss black men wholesale from office, and he will remember that the Negro in the United States has a right to be heard and considered. These absurd predictions sound like those of a man insisting that a scorpion that has already shown its sting is not going to sting anyone. Why then would an intelligent man like Du Bois say such nonsense? In other words, notwithstanding his personal desire to settle scores with Washington and Roosevelt, why didn't Du Bois go with the higher cause of stopping Wilson and his party's known racism? We can answer this question by looking at Du Bois' subsequent career. In the years following Wilson's two terms, in which Du Bois's predictions proved to be the very opposite of the truth, Du Bois moved on from Wilson and proceeded to become enamored with both Stalin and Hitler. In 1936-37, Du Bois made a trip to Europe that included visits to Russia and Germany. He praised Stalin for making a brave start at scientific planning by investing the ownership of all land and materials in the public and then using natural wealth and resources for the ultimate good of the mass of inhabitants. Du Bois refused to criticize Stalin's purge trials and actually defended his forced relocation of small land-owning peasants, apparently regarding such repressive measures as necessary to establish a state-run egalitarian paradise. What attracted Du Bois to Stalin was his socialism, which Du Bois came to understand as the most uncompromising form of progressivism. On Stalin's death, Du Bois proclaimed him a great man who pursued real socialism. And this is also what Du Bois appreciated about Hitler. Traveling through Nazi Germany, Du Bois praised Hitler's dictatorship as absolutely necessary to put the state in order, and praised Hitler's social programs such as national health, living wage, new public housing projects, and new public works of all kinds. Du Bois found the Nazi state to be a content and prosperous whole. While Du Bois deplored Hitler's racism toward blacks, he attributed Hitler's vilification of Jews to reason prejudice or an economic fear. Du Bois' blind appreciation for Hitler mirrors his blind appreciation for Stalin, and indeed the two dictators, notwithstanding their subsequent clash on the battlefield, were close ideological cousins. They were, in fact, both National Socialists. While Marx and Lenin both viewed communism as international socialism, Stalin had emphasized socialism in one country, socialism for Mother Russia, in short, National Socialism. Hitler, too, was a National Socialist who headed the German National Socialist Workers' Party. Historian Stanley Payne, in A History of Fascism, remarks on the parallel between Stalinist socialism and German National Socialism. Much earlier, the Russian socialist Trotsky recognized the similarity, contending that Stalinism and fascism were symmetrical phenomena. Both Hitler and Stalin were champions of the all-powerful state, and they sought a remaking of society and even of human nature in subordination to the centralized state. Du Bois's naked admiration for tyrants like Stalin and Hitler proved an embarrassment to his allies at the National Organization for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, whose magazine, The Crisis, Du Bois edited for many years. The NAACP fired Du Bois, who eventually left America in disgust and became a citizen of Ghana, where he eventually died a bitter and broken man. This progressive icon came to hate America because, in his view, America did not take the strong measures that Stalin and Hitler did to bring strongman socialism and centralized state power to their countries. This, then, is the tragedy of America's leading African-American progressive. He backed Wilson against TR, identified with the Democratic Party at the time when most blacks were Republicans, and then later became a devotee of Stalin and Hitler, all because he embraced the progressive vision of the centralized state. In 1912, Du Bois saw Wilson as a more reliable champion of centralized state power than TR. Ultimately, that and Du Bois' personal grudge counted more for Du Bois than even Wilson's blatant documented commitment to white supremacy. Du Bois' betrayal